Now, as you can see, the law is divided into chapters and sections, and it really covers, I think, every aspect of treating a dying patient, from general fundamental principles and definitions through assumptions, chazokes, that we established as the basis for the ongoing law, through particulars of treatments, whether one wants extraordinary treatment to prolong life or one wants to die sooner, there are forbidden acts and allowed acts, and even the allowed acts, what form of act can be done in order to allow it, how do you do with palliative care, especially minors and dependents. We heard some issues about minors. These are very difficult questions because even children and newborns are dying and someone has to make a decision. We have a large chapter on advanced directives with a lot of chidushim there, even for Western societies who adopted advanced directives. We did it in a very innovative way, and people are starting to adapt some of our ideas. And we took it out totally from the courts. The concept was that a judge is not better to make a decision on a dying patient than a shoemaker or a bus driver or anyone else. He's just another human being with another background. He doesn't have any legal competency to make this ethical decision whether a patient should die or not, and therefore it is out of the courts. It's the first time that a law establishes a situation where it doesn't go to the courts. It goes to National Ethics Committee and Institutional Ethics Committee, and the committees are a very broad mixture of people, and hence the difficult questions will come to those committees rather than to courts. So that is a very innovative idea. I would like to spend some time on a few aspects that the law has taken into consideration. First question is, we are talking about a dying patient. What is a dying patient? Who is a dying patient? By the way, the English terminology of a terminal patient is a total misnomer. What does it mean that this patient is terminal? It means that we are not terminal. We will live forever and he is terminal. Everyone is terminal. So by saying that this particular patient is a terminal patient, we didn't say anything. We all are terminal. And hence, the definition, who is a dying patient, is a very crucial issue. So from a halachic point of view, we had a difficulty to define who is called a notel amut, a dying patient. We assumed that we are talking about a situation that halachically is termed chayei sha'ah. And obviously, chayei sha'ah versus chayei olam is not the exact wording. Chayei sha'ah doesn't mean someone who will live 1 hour, and chayei olam doesn't mean someone who will live forever. Chayei sha'ah is a temporary life, chayei olam is less temporary. But where is the limit between the two? So in the Talmud, we find discussions about the status of someone who has only chayei sha'ah left. But the Gemara doesn't define how long is chayei sha'ah. Chayei sha'ah is a day, is a week, is a month, is a year, is 5 years. How much is chayei sha'ah? So there are a lot of halachos regarding chayei sha'ah, but no definition of what chayei sha'ah is. The poskim in later generations have equivalented the situation of chayei sha'ah to a treifa, time-wise, not halachically. And since treifa is defined as 12 months, hence the consequent is that chayei sha'ah is defined as 12 months. This is the Achiezer, the Rav Kook, the Moshe Feinstein, Shlomo Zalman Auerbach. A lot of the poskim have come to this conclusion that chayei sha'ah is 12 months. Now, the source of the discussion on chayei sha'ah that is different than chayei olam is a very interesting discussion. We don't have time to get into it. These are the four lepers that, according to the Gemara, were Gehazi and his three sons, which raises an interesting question. How do you learn a halacha from Gehazi that Chazal say that doesn't have a chelek le'olam haba? He was such a roshe that he lost his part in chayei olam haba, and yet the whole basis of discussing the concept of chayei sha'ah halachically is derived from what they did in the situation that they were in a chayei sha'ah. It's an interesting discussion by itself, but according to the Gemara, chayei sha'ah situation is different than chayei olam in a sense that a person in chayei sha'ah is allowed to take greater risks than someone who has chayei olam. Because anyway he's going to die, he can take certain risks that maybe he will live longer, maybe he will live shorter, but because in total his chances are only chayei sha'ah, he's allowed to take these risks. The later poskim have used the concept to the other direction, that someone who has chayei sha'ah is allowed not to prolong those chayei sha'ah by active means. That is where chayei sha'ah comes into discussion. So already the Chochmat Shlomo, brought down by the Darkei Tshuva, asked the question, what we say, chayei sha'ah lo chayshinan, kama hu shiur chayei sha'ah, ki lo nitparesh. We don't find, up to the most of the achroinim even, not in the Gemara, not in the Geoinim, not in the Rishoinim, not in the Rishoin achroinim, we don't find a definition. And as you can see, most poskim came to the conclusion that it is 12 months, as I said, and here are some of the sources. And the same, Reb Moshe in our time says, שלפי דעת הרופאים לא יחיה יותר משנה, שהוא בחשיבות טריפה לרופאים, and therefore, since טריפה, we know how long it is, so we can define חיי שעה. The one posek who doesn't accept this definition is Rav Eliashiv. He doesn't accept the definition of Yudbet Chodesh. I personally don't know why, but that's what he said, and therefore, as you will see, he opposed a certain part in the law that we build on the assumption that chayei sha'ah is 12 months, and he, since he didn't accept it, he didn't accept the end result of what we said in the law. Another issue is, what is the value of life from a Jewish perspective? I already told you at the first lecture that in secular ethics, especially in ethics coming out of the United States, the value of life per se has lost its meaning altogether. It's not counted at all as a value. It is the autonomy of the person, the beneficence to the person, and so on, but life per se is not one of the paradigms of ethics. In Judaism, it is certainly not true, and the value of life is the most important value that we have, and all values are subdued to the value of life so that life can continue one way or another. So how big is this value? How important is this value? So there's a minority position amongst the poskim that the value of life is an absolute value. Now, in philosophy, if you say on a value that it's absolute, it means that there are no exceptions to the rule. Because once there is an exception, then it becomes relative to this exception. And if it's absolute, it can't have any exceptions. So if we accept the philosophy that the value of life is infinite and absolute, then we must extend life by all means, in all conditions, for everyone, no matter how much suffering, no matter what the patient's wishes are, and in the United States you may add, no matter how much it costs, because everything boils down to the dollar in the United States. So every aspect that you can think of, you have to put aside and prolong life. So if you have a dying patient and you accept the position that value of life is absolute, we don't need any law and we don't need to discuss and you can go home earlier, because the answer will be, do everything you can to every patient for every minute of life, and you have no shikul hadat, you have no right to make any calculations whether to treat or not to treat. That would be, according to the minority position, the forerunner of this position is the Tzitz Eliezer. I have discussed with him many times. I have a lot of questions on this position. I didn't get from him a clear answer how he justifies his position, but he stayed with his position. So according to the Tzitz Eliezer, you have to treat everyone, no matter what, even if he's suffering terribly, extend his life as much as you know and can at the time. Majority position, almost all poskim that I know, feel that the value of life is indeed extremely important, but it is not an absolute value. By saying it is not an absolute value, we are saying that occasionally other values can override the value of life. And hence, you have a shikul adat, you have an option not to prolong life in certain circumstances. What are the circumstances? This is the whole law that we are trying to say, what can you do, what can't you do, and why. But at least we have the option to think about not to extend every life. And I can cite a lot of sources that indeed this is the position. The most famous one is the story of the last day of Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi. I assume everyone knows the Gemara in Ksubas, that he was suffering terribly, and his Talmidim said, like probably the Tzitz Eliezer, we must extend his life by all means. The means that they had was davening, so they were praying for HaKadosh Baruch Hu to extend the life of Rebbe, despite the fact that he was suffering terribly. His female servant was of the opinion of what today is the majority of the poskim, that terrible suffering in a case of Chayei Shoah, it was clear that Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi is going to die, you don't have to extend this life. But who is she compared to the Talmidim? They are davening and HaKadosh Baruch Hu listens to them. How can she do something? So the story goes that she went up on the roof, she threw down a jar, the jar made a noise, the Talmidim got frightened for a moment, they stopped a minute to daven, and Malach HaMavet could penetrate the respirator and take the neshama of Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi. So we have a machloikes between Talmid Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi and the servant of Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi. How is the aloche? Says the Ran in Edorim, in another place, that the aloche is like the servant, not like the Talmid. And indeed, says the Ran, not only don't you have to pray for the continuation of the living of a suffering, dying patient, but in fact you should pray for him to die. We held a discussion earlier, what should you pray in such situation? Lehaloche, you should pray the patient should die. I never encountered a shul that they make a mishaberach to a choyle sheyamut. This I didn't see yet. But it seems from the Ran that that is what you should do. The Tzitz Eliezer has a whole big tshuva, who can pray and what should they say, and the family sometimes is nogea bedover, that they don't want the suffering encountered. So there's a whole discussion. But be it as it may, it is clear from this story that life is not an absolute value. If it would have been an absolute value, then the aloha should be like the Talmidim of Rebbe and not like the servant. Now, the Stipeler has a very interesting letter in the book, the collection of his letters, the Karyana de Gerta, and he says that when he was a child, he heard that life is of infinite value and you have to do anything you can to prolong life. He says, "Be'inai davar ze tzarich iyun gadol." He doesn't understand what it is, and he assumes that someone who doesn't know what he's talking about said it, and it just continue to be said because he doesn't understand it, and according to his position, if it is Chayei Sha'ah, you don't have to prolong the life with suffering. And the reasons are some of the reasons that I said. The same holds true with Rav Moshe, but he went one step further. Rav Moshe says, Nireh lefaniyu dati, dekevan sheno lerapoto, if it is Chayei Sha'ah, it means that the physicians say, I can't cure him. I can only extend a little bit his life. Otherwise, if I can cure him, then it becomes Chayei Olam. The fact that I call him Chayei Sha'ah is because I can't cure him. So what can I do? Ela le'arich hayav eiz shah. I can prolong his life a little bit. Im chayei ha'sha'a sheyichye al yedei emtzaim shel harofim yiyye b'yesurim, says Rav Moshe, asur. Not only don't you have to prolong his life, but actually it's forbidden to do it. Where he takes the isur, I don't know. I discussed this matter with Shlomo Zalman Auerbach, and he didn't know either. And he said that, in his view, Rav Moshe went a little too far to say that there is an isur to add life, but in his opinion, there is certainly no chiyuv to add life. And in conditions which we don't have the time to go into, one is allowed not to extend chayei sha'a with suffering. But according to Rav Moshe, it might be even an isur, and he repeats it in the tshuva again, as you can see at the end of this slide, Ela vaday de asur la'asot emtzaim la'arich chayei sha'a be'ofen sheyeh be'yisurim. You are forbidden to prolong life of chayei sha'a if it adds suffering. So that is a unique position of Rav Moshe. Everyone quotes the source of Meisir HaMoneh, which Dr. Gesundheit already alluded to, removing the impediment, and that is the most powerful reason, which I discussed with the Tzitz Eliezer and couldn't understand his position. You can't say that life is of absolute value if you are allowed to remove an impediment. If a patient, according to those days, is staying alive because a wood chopper is making noise, according to the Tzitz Eliezer, you have to invite 10 more wood choppers in case this wood chopper gets tired and he stops making noise and the patient will die. You have to prolong his life. Not only don't you have to bring more wood choppers, but according to the deen, you have to tell the wood chopper to stop and the patient should die. If life is of infinite and absolute value, how can you stop the means that continue his life? So it's clear, and this is the halacha, the Ramo brings it, the halacha in Shulchan Aruch, that if the person is in a dying situation, that is goises man aruch, it's not a regular goises, but it's a chayei sha'a, someone who is dying within a period of time, and a noise disturbs his neshome from departing, and he is suffering, you should stop, or you are allowed to stop, depending on the different positions, and let the patient die. Now, if we would go from the ethical point of view, and we'll take the principle of autonomy, which in some circles of ethicists, this is the overriding principle, if you would say that autonomy is an absolute value, then again, life would be easy to those who would accept it. You ask the patient, you want to die now? He says, yes. You take out the pistol and you shoot him, because he wants to die now. If he says, I want you to put me on dialysis machines, and I want an ICU, and I want a respirator, and the physician says, no chance that it will do anything, but he says he wants it. So, you should do it. In America, you probably won't do it because it costs money, and then the money will take away from the autonomy. But if you go by pure autonomy, you should do it. I don't think that there are many, if at all, that feel that the principle of autonomy is an absolute value. So even if it is an important value, it is not an absolute. Therefore, in most instances, indeed, we should respect patients' wishes, but in certain circumstances, we can override his wishes and not regard his autonomy. Now, is autonomy in this sense acceptable halachically? Can a patient say, I don't want to live anymore because I am suffering, and therefore I don't want you to connect me to a respirator once I will go into arrest? The answer is yes. Although autonomy is quite limited in halacha, I can't autonomously sit on Shabbos and write a letter to my friend, because halacha doesn't allow me. So my autonomy is very restricted. But in chayei sha'a, suffering, autonomy is acceptable. And that is what Rav Moshe says, l'inyan ze ika ba'alut la'adam al chayuto. He, for this purpose, he is the owner of his body, which is not a simple sentence, and I won't go into the debate around it. שלכן היה שייך למילף מגחזי ובניו כדלאל, לכן מסתבר, סז רב מוישה, שאם החולה אינו רוצה, משום שעדיף לו חיי שעה ודאים מספק חיים המרובים, רשאי שלא להתרפות. He is allowed to say, I don't want to get this treatment because this type of temporary life is not for me anymore. I don't want it. And he said it again in another tshuva, and Reb Shlomo Zalman Auerbach in his tshuva says the same thing, that you tell the patient and you ask him, and if he says, I don't want anymore, then you listen to him. So autonomy in this sense of chayesho, suffering, is acceptable halachically. Now the question of palliative care. Palliative care is intended to ameliorate pain and suffering. However, palliative care has side effects. And occasionally, the treatment kills the patient. Are you allowed to give a palliative care that has a potential of hastening death? The answer is not only are you allowed, but in fact you are required halachically to palliate suffering patients in end of life, even if occasionally a patient will die of it. Now this is not the double effect of the Christians. The double effect of the Christian says that if your intention is for good, even if 100% there will be bad coming out of it, since you didn't intend it, that is okay. In Halacha, we have a concept, psik reisha. If you say, I intend to take the head of the chicken, but I don't intend to kill it. In order to take the head, I am cutting off the head of the chicken. And I only want the head. I don't want to kill the chicken. That is nonsense, because 100% of cases that you will do it, the chicken will die. So if it is a situation of psik reisha, a situation where if you give this treatment, it will 100% kill the patient, the double effect doesn't help. Your intention may be nice, but your acts are wrong. When is it permissible? Only if it is occasionally so. In other words, usually when I give this treatment, it doesn't kill, but occasionally it kills. So why should I do it to a patient? Said Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach the following svara. If you have a patient with brain tumor, what do you do to him? You take him to the operating room in order to evacuate the brain tumor, in order to save his life. But about 10% die on the table. So there is a mortality rate to your treatment. Should we say that because some patients die of the treatment, therefore no patient will get the treatment? No one is saying it in medicine. You're doing what you do for a good purpose. In most instances, the good indeed results. And there are side effects. Now, if you will look at the terminal pain and suffering as a brain tumor, and at the morphine as a neurosurgical procedure, you'll get to the same idea. You treat the pain, which is the brain tumor, with morphine, which is the surgery, and in a certain percent, patients die. Now, the palliative people today, which is a very advanced field in medicine, claim not only don't they kill patients, and the rate in good hands is less than 1% mortality with full amelioration of pain, but in fact they prolong life with it. Because pain in such a severe degree in dying patients creates all kinds of chemicals that hasten death. And if you reduce the pain, you reduce the production of this type of endorphins, and therefore the patients even live longer. So certainly palliative care in good hands is something that should be done even from a halachic point of view. I already asked this question that Tzitz Eliezer, as you can see here, a question that I posed to him in Tafshin Lamed Zayin over 30 years ago, whether you should give morphine or not, and the Tzitz Eliezer Paskin, mutar latet lachole hagam shemeidachem amazikim lo ve'alulim gam lekarev yoter et mitato. I made him aware that sometimes this treatment may kill a patient, and yet it is permissible. And the same of Shlomo Zalman Auerbach said the same psak, that if it is not directly killing the patient or 100% killing the patient, then you should give this palliative treatment. Now, the major issue is, how do we treat a dying patient? What are the limits of the treatment? How far do we go? So this can be divided into three parts of philosophy. If you take the value of life as an absolute one, then the treatment is everything. Whatever you can do, you should prolong life. If you take the autonomy as an overriding principle, then active euthanasia makes a lot of sense. The patient says, I can't bear any more my life. I will not die from my disease now. I will die within 6-8 months from now. I don't want this 6 months. What can I do for him? The only thing I can do for him is kill him now. So if autonomy is the overriding principle and life is not a value at all, then active euthanasia makes sense. What is called passive euthanasia is a balancing power between the two extremes. We don't take the value of life as an absolute one. We don't take the autonomy as an absolute one. We take the value of life as very important, and some take autonomy as very important, and we have to balance between them. And that is the difficult task of everyone. And as I said already several times, physicians don't like this approach. Physicians don't like to think. They like to get a protocol. It says you do so, you do so. You don't have to think. So if we go to extremes, then it makes life easier. I don't have to think. Either I treat the patient with whatever I have, or I do to him whatever he wants me to do. But if I have to think, this patient, I'll do so, and this patient, I'll do differently, that is a problem to many physicians. And therefore, we need rules. We need guidelines. Now, most of the countries in the world have guidelines in a form of ethical guidelines, which are not binding from a legal point of view, but they give directions. We felt in Israel that that will not be sufficient. Israeli physicians never read ethical literature. I'm not saying they're not ethical as people, but they don't read it. They do whatever they feel is right. And unless there is a law that says this is what you do and this is what you don't do, everyone will do differently. We did a small study in a few hospitals in Israel, and the same type of patients who were admitted in one hospital got different treatment than in another hospital. Sometimes within this hospital, in geriatrics A, they got this type of treatment, and in geriatrics B, they got another type of treatment, and sometimes two physicians in the department would treat the same type of patient differently. So obviously this can't be in a country, and therefore I was asked to see if we can come up with a law. Now, I don't have time to go into the details of the law, as I said, but I want just to touch two little points. One is, we invented a timer. Dr. Gesundheit already alluded to the Shabbos clock that was posed to the Tzitz Eliezer, who agreed with it. There is a tshuva by Reb Moshe, who says that if a patient on a respirator is hooked up to a balloon of oxygen, in those days there wasn't central oxygen, the respirator was hooked to a balloon, and the balloon finishes, you don't have to renew it. He goes even further to say that if you disconnect the respirator for suctioning, which is part of the regular working with a respirator, you don't have to reconnect him because you disconnected him for a right purpose. You didn't disconnect him in order to kill him, you disconnected him in order to treat him. We felt that this would be too dangerous to say that it's sufficient to disconnect for suction and then not reconnect, because then physicians will play with it too freely. And therefore, we went on the timer concept. The timer concept is a little different than a Shabbos clock. Shabbos clock wouldn't work on a respirator. It was a theoretical question. But as you all know, the respirators are built in such a way that when there is an electrical shortage, it restarts itself. Imagine if it wouldn't be like this, every time the power goes off, hundreds of patients would die because there will be no power to the respirator that they are on. So the respirators have an automatic way to restart themselves. So if a regular Shabbos clock will stop it, it will restart itself and we didn't do anything. So we build a special timer. It is now in the process of a medical experimentation. And once it will be approved, it will be something that many would like to adopt. It got the approval. Certainly it comes from the Tzitzel Ezer and Moshe Feinstein, but we discussed it specifically with Rav Neuwirth, with Rav Moshe Weiss, with Rav Zalman Chaim Goldberg, with Rav Avigdor Neventzal, with Rav Mordechai Eliyahu. I mean, a lot of the poskim in Israel, and everyone agreed that this is a form that should be allowed. Now, what is the basis for that? We distinguish halachically, and it is a svore. I don't know the source for it, but Shlomo Zalman made it a very clear point every time a question on end of life was posed to him, between a continuous treatment and a cyclic treatment. Take, for example, dialysis. How do we treat a regular dialysis patient? He comes on Sunday, he's being hooked up to the dialysis machine for 4 hours, and then as part of the treatment, you take him off the dialysis machine, he goes home, and on Tuesday he comes back to be hooked up. Now, if I as a physician give an order dialysis, I mean that he should do it Sunday, Tuesday, Thursday, Sunday, Tuesday, Thursday. For me, it is a continuous treatment. But the treatment inherently is a cyclic treatment. Each new unit of treatment is a new decision. So if I'm allowed to withhold further treatment from a chayei sha'a suffering patient, each time that the cycle finished and I have to reintroduce a new cycle is a new decision. And therefore, I am allowed, halachically, not to start the next shift of the treatment. And if you'll think about it, most treatments are of this nature. Chemotherapy, you don't get continuous chemotherapy 7 days a week. You get a bulk of chemotherapy, and then after 10 days, you get another bulk. So then again, you start with a new decision. The respirator is different. You can't hook up a patient who is in need of a respirator on Sunday morning, take him off, send him home, and telling him to come on Tuesday back, because he'll never come back, right? It's impossible. And hence, a continuous treatment, if you stop it, that is halachically considered an act of euthanasia. No matter what you intend, the American philosophy is that you don't intend to kill him, you just intend to stop the treatment. But that is exactly the psik reisha v'lo yamud. You don't intend to kill the chicken, you just intend to take off his head. So here, you don't intend to kill the patient, you take him off the respirator, but you know that if he's respirator dependent, by this act, you killed him. So this can't be done. But if you put the respirator on a time span, and the time span finishes, like the balloon in Reb Moshe's days, or the timer today, then to restart the respirator is again a new unit of treatment, and actually we turn the respirator, technically, from a continuous treatment into a cyclic treatment. And therefore, that is permissible according to most of the poskim. I want to finish with a letter that was published about 15 years ago. And the story of this letter is as follows. The question was posed to most of the poskim, what do you do in end-of-life situations? So 4 poskim were asked simultaneously. Shlomo Zalman, Arav Eliashiv, Arav Vozner, and Arav Karelitz. 2 from Jerusalem, 2 from Bnei Brak. Now, I don't know if you know how these gedolim operate, but despite the fact that they have telephones, I don't know if they have cell phones, but they have telephones, and I'm sure they know how to dial, but they don't do it. So in order to get 4 gedolim to write 1 letter, you have to go from one to the other, show him what the first one wrote, he amends it or changes it, you go back, and that's the process that things have done. So We finally got this letter. מדין תורה חייבים לטפל בחולה, אפילו אם לדעת הרופא הינו חולה סופני הנוטה למות, even if he is a dying patient, you must treat him. How? בכל התרופות והטיפולים הרפואיים השגרתיים כפי הצורך. Everything that routinely you treat a patient, you should do it. חלילה לקרב קיצו של חולה סופני כדי להקל על סבלו, you shouldn't hasten the death of a dying patient even for the purpose of ameliorating his suffering by על ידי הימנעות ממתן מזון או טיפולים רפואיים, כל שכן שאסור לקרב קיצו על ידי מעשה. This is a statement. להלן רשימת טיפולים רפואיים כפי שנוסחו על ידי רופאים בכירים. We were three physicians. We were called רופאים בכירים here in this statement. And the question between Shlomo Zalman and Rav Eliashiv was, should the list that I'll show you in a minute be included in the psak or should it be separate? Shlomo Zalman said it is part of the psak and it should be in the psak. And Rav Eliashiv said, I'm not a physician. I don't know exactly what treatment, yes, what not. So I'm leaving it to the physicians to say, and therefore this is not part of the psak. And it was decided, according to Rav Eliashiv, that it is not part of the psak. So the psak says, you're not allowed to do an act to kill a patient. So you're not allowed to shoot him. You're not allowed to do active euthanasia. You're not allowed physician-assisted suicide. You're not allowed to disconnect a respirator. That is clear. You're also not allowed to hasten his death by not giving him food and fluid and medical treatment. But the medical treatment is not defined in the psak. Where is it defined? By what we, the doctors, have said is the routine medical treatment. And what is it? So as you see, the signatories were Rav Eliashiv, Rav Auerbach, Rav Osner, and Rav Karelitz. Certainly the most prominent poskim, at least in Israel, I think over the world. And after their signature comes the list. And what is the list? אלה הטיפולים הרפואיים כפי שנוסחו על ידי רופאים בכירים. יש להזין את החולה הסופני, you must feed a dying patient, ובמידת הצורך גם על ידי זונדה או פיום קיבה. If you can't feed him by mouth, you have to put an NG tube into him or a peg. He must get food. כמו כן יש לתת עירוי נוזלים לבריד. He must get fluid. He shouldn't die of dehydration. What else? זריקת אינסולין, מורפיום במינון מבוקר, אנטיביוטיקה ומנות דם. What is important in this document is what is missing in the list. It doesn't say that you have to put him on a respirator. It doesn't say that you have to start him on dialysis. It doesn't say that you have to give him chemotherapy. It doesn't say that you have to give him radiotherapy and so on. In other words, what the poskim here have said, you must treat the dying patient as a human being, as if he is not dying. Anything pertaining to his dying situation, you don't have to give him. So, hopefully I'm not a dying patient at the moment. No one knows what goes in, but I feel okay, so I hope I'm not a dying patient. I need to eat. I need to get fluid. There's no difference between me and the dying patient on this level. Therefore, you must provide food and fluid even to a dying patient. If I am a diabetic and I'm getting insulin, there's no difference if I'm dying or not dying. The one difference would be if the dying patient is dying of diabetes as part of his complication of his disease and insulin doesn't help anymore. It just prolongs his life. Then it becomes a treatment pertaining to the dying situation. And then you would be allowed not to continue the next treatment. And finally, I want to tell a personal story. When my father was dying, he was on a drip of dopamine. That was the only thing that kept him alive, kept his blood pressure. He was comatose. He was on dialysis. He had a heart failure, and his blood pressure was very low, and he got a drip of dopamine. And this kept him going on. So I went up from his arm in Auerbach, and I asked, what do I do in this situation? So he told me, whatever is in the bottle at the moment, you're not allowed to stop. once this bottle finishes, you don't have to put again dopamine in the next bottle. And that was really a very dramatic moment, because we knew exactly when my father is going to die. It will take 15 minutes, 20 minutes after the bottle will stop. We had time to gather all the family, and indeed my father died in that way. And that was Shlomo Zalman's position, to distinguish between a continuous and a cyclic treatment, and that is only one part of this law that I wanted to share with you. Thank you.
Well, most of the patients,
they say their mouth is dry. Okay. Right. Let me just clarify some of the statements you made. The idea to make a patient comfortable is important, but it is not the end of what you have to do. The patient also has to live or not die from something which a patient shouldn't die of. He should die of his cancer. He should die of his infection that can't be controlled. But he shouldn't die of dehydration. No human being should die of dehydration unless you as a physician feel that giving him fluid will complicate his medical situation. And I went over the literature, I spoke with a lot of, I'm not a palliative medicine specialist, but I'm very much involved in it, and I think that most physicians confuse between ethics and medicine. And they have the feeling that the patient has to die comfortably, and prolonging his life by hydrating him is making him uncomfortable. Therefore, it becomes a medical indication to stop it because it causes complications. You should be honest with yourself when you treat a patient. I'm not talking about you personally. I mean, a physician should be honest with himself. Is it indeed a medical indication not to hydrate the patient? And there are occasions like this. That's clear. Now, what our policy is, that we put a peg in patients that we know that eventually will get to a stage that they won't be able to eat. Most literature says that putting a peg doesn't make any difference. Why? Because they consider the peg in the last days of life. That doesn't make any sense. Obviously, to put a peg in the last days of life, A, you can't really evaluate whether he died because of the complication of the peg, or he would die anyway because he was at the last days of his life. There are no controlled studies to show what really was the reason for dying. But primarily, obviously at this stage, it's useless. But if you put the peg much earlier, I do it with my pediatric patients with neurodegenerative diseases, with severe neurometabolic diseases that I know that will come to a stage where they won't be able to eat by mouth, we put them the peg when they are in a good condition, no complications almost whatsoever. We're not necessarily using the peg at this stage, but we have prepared it, and when the patient gets to a level where he can't eat by mouth, he can very well be fed by peg without complications. So I think that conceptualizing that putting a peg is a futile treatment for a dying patient, which is the language used by a few ethicists who really were able to transmit it to the large society, is certainly questionable. There are no controlled studies that show that that is true. And in fact, we are now trying to make a controlled study to see whether it makes a difference or not. And from my personal experience, it does make a difference if you do it right. But that is a different argument that we can talk another time, or maybe in the next conference.
The next conference, please, God. I think that's the best idea. He has a flight to Israel at 10 to 5 tonight. So we will let him go. And please, God, we'll have him back, and hopefully all of you back. And I want to thank everybody. I want to give a special thank you to Laser. Dr. Friedman, he asked me I should call him Laser, but at the end I'll just say, you know, Laser Friedman for his tremendous help and really all the aspects of the conference, and to everybody really, and all the speakers, all of you, and we're very interested in it. Besides the evaluation forms, they rhyme again. Put in the evaluation forms, the blue things, rip them out, we're in school, you know, all that kind of stuff. I'd like to hear any informal, formal, you know, ideas and suggestions and feedback. Thank you. I hope you had a wonderful weekend. I know that we did, and I think the weather is nice. We have to check out by 1 o'clock, but you can enjoy Tremblant Blanc the rest of the afternoon, go on the gondola, for et cetera. And it was nice meeting many of you I did not know and seeing you know, and I know, like Laser said,